This is the Paula Gordon Show. We're delighted that Randall Kennedy, who teaches law at Harvard, is our guest. Bill, you started on experts. You can continue on that if you like.
Well, this whole legal issue is rich and complex because the law is sort of we treat it as part of the substrate of how a society does what a society does.
Particularly in this litigious society.
Particularly in this country. And there's a tendency to assume that the law is not only reasonable, that it is logical. And reading this book suggests that that may be a bit of a stretch, particularly the logic part of it. The reasonableness gets into another issue. But part of the test, I would assume, there must be a legal description, but is a reasonableness test. With the average person, and the problem, of course, with that is what is reasonable in 2003 and what is reasonable in 1776 is radically different, and it's also radically different from California to New York or New York to Georgia, and yet this is the substrate. This is how we sort of, when everything else fails, this is why these cases end up in court. When everything else fails, we go to court to get some sort of resolution with the hope that the court will provide a correct, sustainable, and just response. And yet your book is just eaten up with examples of that not only not being the case, but of just flagrant disregard, or what appears to be to a casual observer, flagrant disregard for all of the above, and it has something to do with something else.
Some of the most interesting cases that I came across were cases in which judges were confronted with two opposing values. Let me give you an example. For much of American history, there were laws that prohibited people from different races from marrying. So North Carolina was one of those states. So let's go to a North Carolina case in the late 19th century. It's against the law for people of different races to marry. Or to have sexual relations. But actually, marriage was the thing that was policed far more than sexual relations. There was a wink-wink often with sexual relations. Marriage was a different matter.
Because?
Well, because with respect to marriage, then we're talking about money. Now we're talking about transfer of wealth.
It's also a social contract.
Absolutely. We're talking about the state.
Yeah.
The state comes in and sanctifies a marriage. It's legitimate. I mean, legitimacy is on display with marriage, whereas with sex, that's different in a lot of places. In fact, there were a number of states. In fact, the state I'm from, South Carolina. South Carolina, in 1895, made it against the law for people of different races to marry. In fact, they put it in the state constitution. At the 1895 Constitutional Convention in South Carolina, there was a black representative there who said, okay, fine, what we should do, since we're going to outlaw interracial marriage, let's also outlaw interracial sex. Let's say, in fact, that any legislator who is found to be engaged in interracial sex can no longer be a legislator. That was voted down.
Well, I can't imagine why.
And, of course, the reason why was because many of these white supremacists who were saying, we're against amalgamation, we're against miscegenation, had black mistresses. And so this black representative simply wanted to underline the hypocrisy there. But the basic point is interracial marriage has typically been far more carefully policed than interracial sex. Well, let's go back to our North Carolina case. White man is married to what he perceives to be a white woman. They have kids. The man gets tired of the woman, wants to divorce her. He figures out the following strategy. He will hire a private investigator to take a look at the lineage of his wife. He finds out that his wife had, let's say, a colored grandmother. That makes his wife colored under state law. That means that he was never legally married to his wife. That means that he can get an annulment and not owe his wife any money, vis-a-vis alimony. He can be rid of his kids and not have to pay any child support.
Because they're illegitimate.
So the man does all of this. he goes and faces the courts. The courts, on the one hand, don't like miscegenation. They don't like the idea of interracial intimacy. On the other hand, and here's the big surprise that I found, on the other hand, these judges don't like the idea of letting these men get away with this. They are facing a white woman who's been perceived as white in this community.
Which matters.
Which matters a lot. I mean, if this woman is now deemed colored, these judges are saying, my God, this woman will be in a terrible position. She will be thrown out of the white community. Black people will probably not accept her. These children will be in limbo. And so the judges found over and over again that the woman was, in fact, not colored, even when it was, in fact, true that she was under state law. The judges would find some sort of way to prevent these white men from divorcing their, quote, colored wives.
But it wasn't because they were nice guys, and it wasn't just that they thought ill of the, as you call them, cads. I hadn't heard that word in a long time.
You use two words that are central to this. One is cad, and words that I never hear, almost never hear. One is cad that we're talking about now, and the other is mau-mauing that I haven't seen in a while.
Twice you say mau-mauing. Wow!
We can get to later, but that characterization in this context of cads, and it is really a theme in some ways, the abuse of the law, the abuse of discrimination. The abuse of these racial characterizations, these ambiguous, extraordinarily ambiguous designations to abuse people, particularly women.
Yeah, well, these judges, you're right. These judges were not enlightened judges. They were white supremacist judges. But, well, one of them said that the chief judge of the North Carolina Supreme Court said straight out, no real man would do this. Even if a man found that his wife was colored, he should just be quiet about it. And so, I mean, he was a white supremacist. Even still, he was essentially shocked by what was going to happen in the real lives of these people. Now, it helped him. It was easier for him to reach this judgment because, of course, the woman in front of him looked white.
Yeah, and that isn't just one single guy. You talk repeatedly about how important that perception. It isn't just the one drop that doesn't exist. It isn't just that. It's also how a person has been perceived by the society. That judging someone to be of color or of white had to do with a lot more than just if you could find
somebody's
grandmother in the proverbial woodpile.
It had to do with performance. So these judges would say on the record, well, gosh, it may be that she has colored lineage, but she was in a white orphanage. She was baptized in a white church. Her best friends are white people. She has voted.
I wondered about that. Women didn't vote then.
Well, so you have to check the time of these cases. Some of these cases were after women got the vote. But the point is that these were white women who had performed in the community as white women performed. And so sometimes the judge said, the lineage might not be altogether white, but in as much as these women have been accepted as white, they have almost an equitable purchase on whiteness as property.
When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about this whiteness as property, as you say, because it seems to me it reflects the ambiguity, the tenderness, the fragility, if you will, how fragile this notion of race is and how much the intimacies threaten the status quo. Our guest is Randall Kennedy. He's written Interracial Intimacies about sex, marriage. We've talked a little about both of those, but we also will talk about identity, adoption, and friendship when we come back in just a moment. Please be with us.